It's 2024 and there's so much to do, but it's hard to know where to start. If your decision paralysis is set in, it's now easier than ever to find the volunteer opportunities that are right for you with Vote Save America's brand new Action Finder. You tell VSA the causes you care about, they'll tell you the most high impact ways to get involved from your state all the way to the White House. Call it the cure for doom scrolling. Go to votesaveamerica.com/volunteer to get started. This is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, DR, and Kai talking about all the news with regard to race and justice of the past week that you should be talking about, that you should know about. And we start with the election coverage because it is an election year, and here we go. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at Pod Save the People for more continuous updates about what's going on in podcast land. Here we go.
Family, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. I am Diara Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
I'm Miles E. Johnson. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Feral Rapture.
I'm Kaya Henderson. You can find me on Twitter at Henderson Kaya.
This is Dre at DRA on Twitter.
So as we get closer to the election, y'all, we're really going to start doing these like kind of campaign election roundups where we just take some of the snapshots of news that we're following just to keep us all informed about what's going on. So we're not going to spend a lot of time, but it does deserve time, particularly Donald Trump having to pay $83.3 million in damages to Jean Carroll for defamation comments he made about her when he was president in 2019. He attacked her character and kicked off years of harassment and threats from his supporters because they're a mob. And so most of the award is $65 million in punitive damages. And jurors concluded that Trump acted spitefully and wantonly toward Carol after she accused him of sexually assaulting her in the 1990s. So, you know, in May, a civil jury in New York found that Trump sexually abused and defamed Carol and awarded her a combined $5 million in damages. And Trump has appealed that. So this is good news. This is good news. I don't know where this man is going to get $83.3 million from, because we know he is not worth that. But we've been having a continuing conversation around what does it mean for a former president and now a presidential nominee to have so many cases and lose so many cases. So we're going to continue to see.
You know, because he has said that his net worth is so high, it is interesting if suddenly he like cannot pay $80 million. It's like you went from being a billionaire to a 500 millionaire to a whatever. So I do like that the amount is totally supposedly doable for Trump, who should be able to pay it. I did see some of the Fox talking points about this were like, you know, the system is trying to bankrupt us. We won't have our things anymore. It won't be our money. The government is just taking things from people. And I'm like, y'all are Fox. What Fox has done to this country, you know, we are not the first people to say it, but to see people in suits and ties on TV and argue that this defamation lawsuit settlement is a bad thing because the government is taking things away from people is just something else.
I guess my very legal focused question is, of course he's gonna appeal, right? But time-wise, could this appeal happen quick enough that he's forced to spend the money and bankrupts his and bankrupt some other stuff, and basically can he bankrupt himself and get out this race? Can that happen?
Wait, can you say the question again? Can he bankrupt himself and get out of this race?
Yeah, so I know that he's gonna probably appeal. So I know that's gonna take time too. And I know that this case in of itself took about like 5 years to get to any type of verdict. But I'm wondering, is there a way that this big amount could maybe make a speed bump or redirect his presidential aspirations? Could this be a greater win for the voting public?
I think there's so many ways to exhaust it in terms of like what the options are for paying it. So he was ordered to pay her $5.5 million in a related case. And he asked the court, the court actually held that money while the appeal was pending, which I found interesting that he even paid that money to the court, but that was reported in the New York Times. He can also try to secure a bond. I mean, an $83 million bond. I mean, oh my God. And because I've had to pay the bond for some of my cousins, and clearly it was nowhere close to $83 million. So trying to secure a bond, which will save him from having to pay the full amount up front. So it's just like there's a ton of different ways, I think, to figure out how to pay this. And so I think that's the issue, is like, are these cases, even if he is losing them, are they going to slow him down? They're not slowing him down in terms of, you know, his base, you know, the impact of his character to his base. So it really is, Miles, to your point, like, is it going to somehow tactically slow him down? And I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what's interesting about, I think there has to be some impact, right? Like, these things are, they might seem small individually, but collectively from these awards that, I mean, just remember this, the first award was just $5 million, and then he yapped his trap about the lady after that $5 million win, and welcome to $83 million world, right? Like, these judges are not playing. These judges are not playing. You should have kept your mouth shut, paid your $5 million for what you did to that lady in the dressing room of Bergdorf Goodman. Oh my gosh, don't get me started. But you should have paid your $5 million and gone quietly into the night. I think that these amounts, Rudy Giuliani, $45 million, or whatever that he has to pay to the two black ladies in Georgia. These people are not playing. They and while the base might be animated by all of this stuff, where do you hit people in their pocketbooks? Donald Trump's whole entire financial profile is all smoke and mirrors. It's all loans. It's all bankruptcies. It's all whatever, whatever. So you get hit with a couple of these things and we know you can't pay. That's why the court asked him to put the $5 million up beforehand. We can't keep having these empty verdicts where people get awarded a lot of money and never see this money. And so I think to have the court ask for the money up front, to ask for a bond, this is helping people understand, like, whatever Fox is saying, let Fox say, but we are going to get these people their justice. And I can't help but think that as these things progress and as he continues to lose, I understand how it's animating his base. But I also understand that if you don't have no money,
you don't have no money.
That is a problem.
And the other thing for our radar is Tish James, the Attorney General of New York, is seeking $370 million penalty from Trump and his family business as part of a civil fraud trial that wrapped up this month. So, and that is in January.
And he was convicted of that, right? Wasn't he convicted of the thing? And so now it is just about what the penalty will be. Right? Yep. So he's lost the case. And if this judge is acting like these other judges, they're not letting these dudes get away with this. It's interesting to watch. I'm eating popcorn.
And like I said last episode, I literally have been reading the Trump's The Art of the Deal book because I just was not aware during Trump's I've only known this Trump and the little bit of the reality television Trump. So I've been trying to like contextualize him better and just in my own culture brain. And it's really interesting to read about somebody who was just like the first chapter of this book is all a week in Trump's life. So it's meeting to meeting, what I'm doing, making this deal, closing this. So it's so interesting to see somebody who's quite literally character is built on how well I can amass wealth and how smart I am when it comes to money. It's wild to see his demise come, not just with like, you know, moral depravity, but also with I can't keep a dollar. Where your whole thing was, oh, I know how to make a dollar into a million, know how to make a million into a billion, you know. So
I think what I thought about a lot this weekend, I watched Nikki Haley on Meet the Press, and What I thought about a lot this weekend is how much the media has created this character and maintains this character. On Meet the Press, Kristen, well, I watched because I really wanted to hear what Nikki Haley had to say. I wanted to see if there was anything there, if there was momentum, if there was whatever, whatever. And they spent 85% of the time talking about Trump. Should he, you know, does she believe that he should get off the ballot? Does she think that he does? Does she think, well, what the hell do you think, Nikki? And Kristen, can you ask her that question? What do you stand for, Nikki? What are you about? What are you going to bring? What is important to you? But the media is so enamored of the Trumpishness that we can't even get a clear assessment of other candidates because all they want to ask other candidates is what they think about Mr. Trump.
I was watching the 92NY, to your point, I was watching the 92NY talk with Liz Cheney, and her whole thing is about Trump. And I'm like,
yeah.
I'm like, sister, if we don't pivot.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Kai, to that point, the way that they have propped him up also leads people to believe that there's some brilliance there, that like there is some, that something there is like really smart or savvy. You're like, no, that man is a clown, and clowns are funny, and a circus is funny. That is what this is, not mm-hmm. brilliance. He just says all the things that you've been taught you can't say out loud because they're inappropriate, rude, and bigoted. He says them and people are intrigued by that. So DR brought up Tish James, and as you know, Tish did that investigation of Governor Cuomo, came out that he has sexually harassed people. It was one of the key moments that led to the end of Governor Cuomo. What you might not have known is that right when that was happening, the Department of Justice also opened an investigation into a former Governor Andrew Cuomo. And it just came out, it was like a dump last week, that the that they concluded that Cuomo violated Title VII rules against discrimination and retaliation between 2013 and 2021. They said that Cuomo and his staff engaged in, quote, a pattern or practice of discrimination against female employees based on sex, and they found that he retaliated against the women. And these are findings from the Department of Justice. They found that he repeatedly subjected women in the office to non-consensual sexual contact, that he gave them gender-based nicknames, and further, that top Cuomo staff, quote, were aware of the conduct and retaliated against four of the women he harassed. Kristen Clark, who runs the Civil Rights Division, who we love, of the Department of Justice, her quote in a statement is, the conduct in the executive chamber under the former governor, the state's most powerful elected official, was especially egregious because of the stark power differential involved and the victim's lack of avenues to report and redress harassment.
Basically, Tish James knew what she was talking about. That's what the Department of Justice
yes.
said. Woo chow. I mean, I'm not even touching this Cuomo stuff because I don't know. But here's what I will say about Tish James. Think about I'm gonna link it to Fannie Willis and to the other woman of color whose name she's a Caribbean sister, I can't remember her name, who's over the other Trump case. Think about the pressure that you have to be under if you're a Black woman bringing these cases against these powerful white men. And what I love about Tish James is she is unafraid. She has dotted every I and crossed every T. She is like, there is a crime here and I'm going to show it to y'all. And so far, she has been right. Now, I don't know Fannie Willis. I don't know nothing about her. I don't know. I hope that these allegations are untrue. And even if they are true, I still hope that she's dotting every I and crossing every T, because who you sleep with in your personal life and all of that jazz don't have nothing to do with me. But I hope that you still understand that as a Black woman prosecuting these powerful men, you got to have the whole thing buttoned up. And Tish, I think, is giving us a great example of, I can show you better than I can tell you. So kudos to the Justice Department for coming behind her and underscoring the work that her team has done. It takes these cases have zillions of documents and lots of investigations and stuff that has to happen. And you have to manage this humongous project. And so my hat's off to her and for these other women who are in the arena doing this work, because it's hard being a Black woman, anything. And for them to be literally in the crucible attacking America's favorite politicians is more than a notion. Come on, Black girl lawyers. I see y'all.
And it's so important. And I always thought about this when it first came out, how important this particular case is in my head. Because the one thing that... out of probably many, but the one thing that always comes into my mind is that Democrats still have their kind of a moral center, you know? Whereas when I think about people in the Republican Party, when I think about people like, of course, Trump, Roy Moore, people who have been just accused of horrible things, but then went on to have actual lives inside of the political lives. I think it's so important that when this happens in the Democratic Party, we call it out, we prosecute it, we don't try to still make this person a part of our political representation, you know. And I'm really glad that this, it's still happening. People are still, you know, you have Black women litigating. We're still showing that, no, we have a moral center. We still know what's right or wrong. It doesn't matter if this person is powerful to us or on our side. Wrong is wrong. And I think that's so important right now. Maybe more than it's, I don't want to be, you know, dramatic, but maybe more than it's ever been. It seems like it's so important to publicly show, no, you can't do bad things and stay in this political club just because you're powerful or just because we can use you.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. I rarely go first, but my news is something that I was like, come on. As you all know, Toni Morrison famously said racism is used as a distraction. And Toni was right about a lot of things. She was certainly right about this. Now, you're gonna be surprised about where I end, but let me start with the airplanes. You probably saw that video that went viral where the door of that airplane essentially came off mid-flight. They grounded the flight and they only gave the people in the plane $1,500 as like their recompense for the door literally coming off mid-flight. And that was a Boeing plane. There's been a lot of pressure on Boeing. They have essentially grounded that particular type of airplane, so it's not flying anymore. You might have seen that while they were grounded, there was another airline that it was like seven or so, or like a handful of the Boeing airplanes that got grounded. There were loose screws that they had to fix. There's a lot of oversight coming to Boeing, blah, blah, blah. What you also should know is that the Republicans have generally been anti-oversight, anti-regulation, simply because it is not good for business. That is their argument. That like, you put more regulation in, you can make a lot more money when it's not as regulated, blah, 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 blah. So then I look up and I see that the right's way of dealing with the airline stuff is to blame it on Black people. Literally, that is the strategy. So Trump, Donald Trump Jr., there was something with a Delta Boeing 757, which is the plane in question. And he tweets, I'm sure this has nothing to do with mandated diversity, equity, and inclusion practices in the airline industry. People are going to die and no one regulating these things gives a Wheels don't just fall off planes without gross incompetence in question. Charlie Kirk, who is, as you know, one of the right-wing racist folks, he said, I'm sorry if I see a Black pilot. I'm going to be like, boy, I hope he's qualified. And the way that they have been trying to essentially fight the regulation of the airline industry is to say the presence of Black people is why the planes aren't good or why there are issues. Matt Gaetz, who, you know, represented Matt Gaetz, He said DEI is destroying our major airlines. Libs of TikTok, which is one of the big TikTok accounts, they pulled this like whole ad from Virgin Atlantic saying that it was like about pronouns. And you're like, wow, this is really nuts. And then Marjorie Greene, who you know is a, just lost her all her mind. She said, I just traveled in the airports across the country just the past few days. You know what I saw in our airports? Migrants, illegal aliens all over in the airport. And I'm bringing it here because, A, I wish there were more Black people in the airline industry. The numbers have essentially not changed. It is flat. 92% of pilots and flight engineers are white. 92% of them are men. That has essentially been the same as long as we have ever measured the numbers. The proportion of pilots and flight engineers who are Black grew from 2.7% in 2018 to 3.6% in 2020. It's negligible. Like, I could tell you all the numbers, but ain't none of them higher than 4 for Black people or Asians. Latinos are higher than all of the other people of color, and they're a whopping 10%. And women, it's less of them. Women went from 9 to 8.3. So, you know, the airline industry remains overwhelmingly white men. That is just who is flying planes or flight engineers. And it just is a fascinating way to see them use race as a way to avoid any accountability for industries, any conversation about regulation and safety, and that race really every single time is the boogeyman. It is the thing that derails people, moves people around, people get excited about it. We even have to address it in forums like the podcast, just so people understand that the racism you're hearing delivered to you with a suit and tie is not true. It is not real. It is just a lie. And I wanted to bring it here because this is one of the things that I was like, really? Of all the things you can say about the airplanes falling apart, it's Black people?
And it's like they know once they say it, because of how information specifically now gets spread, they know once they say it, even if we say 100 times, it's because of this. It's because, you know, they know that something going wrong on an airplane, deaths, trauma because the freaking door falls off, whatever they have to pay out is way less than whatever they're cutting. Like, that's the reason why we could say that 110 times over. But once you just say something in this media landscape in general, it's like you can't almost undo it. It's that's now the new truth. And because you said it, and you said it strong, and you said it loud, now that's the new truth, and that's what's just gonna, like, go in the ethers. And it's just such a, you know, moral depravity doesn't begin to, like, articulate how I feel about that.
I mean, from where I sit, this doesn't have anything to do with airlines, does it? Right? Absolutely nothing to do with airlines. This is, I mean, diversity, equity, and inclusion, belonging, any kind of initiatives around that are under attack writ large. So we started in academia, and they successfully took out Claudine Gay. All of that, the whole Harvard thing, and all of those other presidents, all women, like, these are not coincidences. The whole attack on academia is an attack on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now let's take it to the airline industry. Next, we'll go to banking. Then we'll go to somewhere else, right? And all of this stokes the right-wing playbook around, these people are coming for your jobs. Ain't nobody coming for the airline people's jobs, as your numbers just told us. But now, these people are coming for your jobs. They're unqualified. You are unsafe flying. And that is going to cause, I mean, the people who are worried about jobs, about economic security, about, you know, colorful people, gay people, straight people, trans people, whatever, about these other people coming for their jobs, their place in society. This is just another vehicle to serve up that meal that, you know, that base is ravenous for. And so I think in a couple of weeks, we'll see them go after. They'll do this airline industry thing for a while. I mean, I fly all the time. I ain't seen no migrants in the airport. Look, so as far as I know, the migrants don't have enough money to fly in at the border, right? Deal with the border crisis. But I think right now it's airlines and airports, and we'll see it move to the next place until this has touched so many different industries that the scared base is completely riled up because people are coming from them for them at every turn. This is so wild. Like, it is a lie, whole cloth, right? Like, there is nothing truthful about this. And people are carrying it on the news. And that, I mean, you know, to your earlier point around what Fox has done to this country, like, fake news is not even the right term. Like, this, people just lie, right. Like, make up stuff, lie. And our poor, uneducated populace does not have enough critical thinking skills to understand what is right and what is wrong. And that's why they continue to assault education, because they want to keep us dumb and uninformed.
Well, rewind me a little bit, Kaya, because my mind might have got God. Because for some of the content that I've been seeing, some of the news that I've been seeing, there is something happening at the airports. Or is that just like a systemic... They're making like,
What's happening at the airports?
So I have seen a lot of news stories around things happening with these airplanes.
Yes. But that don't have anything to do with people of color. It has nothing to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's my point. Airlines are failing for airline safety is a question right now.
Exactly. I guess I want to be super duper clear.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So I want to be super clear that there is probably something to look at when it comes to these planes in the sky that we should be concerned about. Whereas, like, I feel like when it comes to the academic stuff, there was a whole bunch of to-do about nothing. Mm-hmm. Where I'm like, oh, there's something happened at the airport.
Oh, I hear what you're saying.
Right. I'm sorry. I did not mean to say that doors are not flying off planes, wheels are not flying off planes. Those things are all true. Those things are all true. And my guess is, if you look at who works at the Boeing plant, it don't have nothing to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion, I might venture to say. Mm-hmm. I am saying the lie is that any of the safety issues have anything to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's all.
And I do think there's a thread here that when it comes to the DEI of it all, there has been a massive decrease in company seriousness in pursuing, engaging, institutionalizing. And in my work, I feel like this sense of meritocracy that a lot of white folks have around, I've worked so hard and, you know, I'm not privileged and yada, yada, yada. I do think there is a through line through, if there is truth around us all being equal, then their whole concept of meritocracy actually crumbles. And I think that helps set up this lie of it all, but it also impacts our everyday lives and how we're functioning or not functioning, because folks are just so unable to see all the inequalities, but then also how sometimes, in some cases, Black people out and overperform. So we don't want to acknowledge that either. Kaya Henderson, Miles,
you
Johnson,
better say it, girl. Kessler. Say it.
So I think it's that too, because I'm also just like this is all, it's everywhere, right? It's everywhere, and it's not just like Trump's base. It's actually like white progressives too. So, you know, I think it's a bigger construct around racism that we have not even begun to pull apart in a way that, it creates conditions for this.
Diara, I didn't even think about, you're right, how this is also a setup for that conversation about meritocracy. And it's like totally a lie, and like it's like the scam way to do it. But this idea that like to question the qualifications and all that stuff. Like this is the other way to do it. You know, like this is the back end way to get you to have that conversation. Yep. Cause then we start saying like the numbers aren't true and da-da-da. Then it becomes, well, who should be a pilot? What makes a good pilot? Da-da-da. You know, like it sneaky.
To your point, DR, y'all are so smart this morning. I'm just got my brain ticking. But to your point, I was just talking to my friend the other day, and so one of my favorite people writers is Fran Lebowitz, and she has this thing where she talks about art, and she says, well, you can hear in the language that how we think about art has changed, because when she was young, it was called the art world, and now it's called the art market, and which tells what is important about art now is really it's about the finance and stuff like that. And what I noticed, and I heard her say this maybe like 2 years ago, and what I noticed right in front of me, a lot of places went from calling themselves organizations in 2020, now they're back to being companies. And it's really interesting to even think about how that language has shifted and letting you know what we care about. And that when it was this kind of rebrand, this, you know, around equity and diversity, that everybody was an organization. And now that people are figuring out, well, you know, rebranding as a good company and as equal and diverse is not necessarily profitable. So we're going to go back to being a company and being here for the profit. It's really interesting that even down to the language, you can hear this kind of shift that's happening to the right.
So I brought this article to the podcast because it sent me on a little bit of an emotional roller coaster. I read the headline, which is "Leading Museums Remove Native Displays Amid New Federal Rules," and I was angry. What do you mean we're taking down Native displays? That's not okay. And then I read the article and I was like, oh, wait a minute. There are some good reasons why we're taking down Native displays. And then as I finished the article and really thought about this, I got mad again. And so I was like, okay, any issue that has me going up and down is worth a conversation on the podcast. And really what this is about is the fact that this month there were some new federal regulations that went into effect. And these regulations require museums and other institutions to obtain consent from Native American tribes before displaying or performing research on Native American cultural subjects. And these new regulations are actually, they were initiated by the Biden administration, and they're actually corrective action to speed up the repatriation of Native American remains, like human remains, funerary objects, and other sacred items that were required by a 1990 law called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, right? In 1990, the federal government said, museums, get a people their stuff back. This is human remains, sacred funeral stuff, important cultural objects. Give them their stuff back. And since the 90s, it has been really, really slow in happening, right? In fact, this process has dragged on for decades. And so the Biden administration jumps in and says, new policies, you know, the regulations require a shorter timeline for the repatriation of things. And the new regulations actually say you gotta do this with the tribes. Tribes have more authority throughout the process. The feds are required to defer to Native American traditional knowledge of lineal descendants, Indian tribes, and Native Hawaiian organizations. And our tribal friends say, even though the new regulations have only been in effect for 2 weeks, they already feel a shift in the tenor of talks with the institutions. So that's a good thing. One of the quotes in the article says, this represents a major shift in practices when it comes to Native American exhibitions at some of the country's leading museums that will be noticeable to visitors. How is it noticeable to visitors? Well, museums are actually covering up displays and removing items from their galleries. In fact, the American Museum of Natural History in New York, which is one of the biggest and most visited museums, is closing two major exhibit halls that show Native American objects, which is about 10,000 feet of space, that 10,000 square feet of exhibition space that will now be off limits to visitors. And they get about 4.5 million visitors a year. I'm worried about that. I'm worried about that. I'll come back to that. There is a woman who's the director of the Museum of Anthropology at the University of Missouri, and she says this is human rights work, and we need to think about it as that and not as science. And she's adding 5 new staff members to work on repatriation because this stuff is complicated, right? It's one thing to say, give the stuff back to the people. It's another thing to figure out the right way to do it, to figure out a way that honors the deceased, that respects the cultural practices around how you treat these things. And a top priority of these new regulations is repatriating more than 96,000 individual human remains that are in institutional holdings. 96,000 individual human remains that are in institutional holdings. I brought this to the podcast because, again, this, to me, this demonstrates the complexities of undertaking a healing process, right? It is net positive that the federal government is requiring museums and institutions to treat these artifacts, human remains, cultural items of cultural significance with the respect that they deserve in an attempt to heal relationships with the Native American community. And it's hard. It's not easy. I also think that it is significant and worrisome that as people visit museums and cultural places where we places that hold cultural significance for us, in many cases, they will not see some of this stuff because the institutions are wrestling with how to deal with this. And then I got mad because I was like, okay, good for my Native people. But what about Black folks? Because y'all got our brains and our bodies all over the place. And in fact, there's no federal regulations for you requiring to that require you to give us our stuff back. In fact, the Natural History Museum has at the Smithsonian, the Washington Post did an investigation, like whole expose. It's a beautiful thing if you go on the Washington Post website to see this racial brain collection and all of this stuff that these people do that people had no idea even existed. But according to the Washington Post investigation, the Natural History Museum has a collection of over 30,000 body parts that people didn't know about until 15 minutes ago. Guess how many of those are Native American? 15,000. So there's a whole nother 15,000 that you know who they belong to. They belong to us. They belong to people that look like me and you. And there is no regulation, no requirement, no process, no anything on giving those pieces back to the communities where they belong. And so on the one hand, I want to commend the feds for undertaking what is a difficult, painful healing, attempt at healing. I want to charge our museums and institutions to figure this out. Like, yes, it's hard, but if you're committed to it, like the lady in Missouri, you hire more staff, you put the resources in place, and you do the right thing. And I want to challenge them all to do the right thing, not just for the Native American community, but for all of the folks, for Black people, for Asian people, for, you know, the disabled people, for gay people, for trans people, for everybody who you have experimented on, institutionalized, stolen body parts, and all of these heinous things that have happened. We all deserve the kind of accountability, the kind of process and collaboration in restoring dignity to our ancestors and our forebearers. That's all I got.
Kaya, you definitely went the way that I was thinking, because I was like, okay, this is fantastic. And this also should be the blueprint for our artifacts. It should be the blueprint for our body parts. This also should be, you know, this is a lofty expectation, but I'm like, go ahead and send this blueprint to Buckingham Palace, because there's some stuff that they need to return to. Because I really think that this era of, and it's a huge era, a long era, so I'm not trying to make it seem like it's a Megan Thee Stallion song, like, short. But, like, this huge era of, you know, these institutions are important, and we get to extract everything around the world and put them under our roof because this is what makes them important. I don't think that's true. And I think that museums are going to have to change the way, what they find important, what they center. Again, I went to the Guggenheim. I'm at the Brooklyn Museum like almost weekly now because I live down the street. And I think there's enough art that is, that can be obtained in history, that can be obtained morally, and also enough art that's being made in the, in modern times to fit a museum. And I think that we don't need to always, I don't think we need to exploit things or steal things in order for these institutions to stay important. And I think we have to totally reimagine what makes these institutions important, because there's just stolen things in everywhere. And what this article did do for me too was think about what psychologically does that do to somebody when they see their history umbrellaed and just cornered inside of this building. Yeah, if that's making sense. So what does it mean that something as vast as Native American culture and history and death and tradition is a corner and a section inside of this bigger house? I think that that says something and communicates something that the through line between that and white supremacy is to me like very clear. And I think that if we are really trying to dismantle some of these ideologies that have been destroying us, it has to start there. It has to start with doing this like harder work. So thank you for bringing this, because I love to hear it, and I do think it should be a blueprint for how other things should be taken care of as well.
And my mind also went to the, it went immediately to Sarah Bartman, otherwise aka Hottentot Venus. And what's interesting is, Kaya, your article took me to another article where the Field Museum in Chicago is doing the same things, but what I didn't, in terms of repatriation, but what I didn't know about the Field Museum is that it evolved from the World Columbian Exposition in 1893. All that to say, like, Sarah, there were all these exposition and like world fairs that happened in America at the turn of the century. And what it was basically displaying folks of color, to exoticize them, to exploit them. And then for Sarah Bartman, her remains were with Paris. They were on display until 1974 and not repatriated until 2002. So it's, again, y'all, it's just like larger issues around this country in particular, and in the world, the Western world, quite frankly, not reckoning with what has happened in terms of racism, oppression, etc. And so we still have all the lineage of all these things because we haven't addressed it as a big cultural, social issue. So it's just, it's wild that even 96,000, like the remains of 96,000 indigenous people, like it's being held in an, it's like, that is wild. Absolutely wild.
There are two things that come to mind that I just want to say. One is that the scope of what the museums has always just, as an adult, I appreciate it more than I ever understood as a kid. Like as a kid, I went to a museum. I'm like, oh, I see the stuff on the thing. I just didn't understand that this is a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of the collection. Just like didn't get it. So I am, so reading this, I'm like, they have the birch bank canoe of somebody. They got darts from 10,000 BC. Like they got all this stuff just in the cabinets in the back that we have never even heard about. That blows my mind. So I'm like, the scope of the theft is just vaster than anything I think our minds have been able to wrap around, because we only see the things on display. So even DR, as you talk about the people and the bodies and the remains, and you know, the article very gently is like, well, you know, they can't put the remains out on display, so they're just like in storage. You're like, well, yeah, they stole people's bodies. It's sort of crazy. So that is wild. The second thing that I am thinking through is, I hope that I almost want the halls to be redone about the repatriation, you know? Like, I want there to be a hall, the hall of repatriation. Like, I don't want people to ever forget the amount of theft. Like, I want there to be pictures of everything they stole, and the hall could be, like, stolen past or something. I don't know. Like, I want people to be for, you know, because the worst version of this is they give it all back and then they paint the hall over something else and people never, like, this whole moment is gone of theft in taking people's culture.
Exactly.
Like, I just don't want that to happen either. Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
Don't you wish everything was more rewarding? With Rakuten, almost everything is. You can earn cash back on those new shoes you've been wanting. You can save on the next trip you book. You can cash in on groceries. Just join, shop your favorite brands, and save. Target, Instacart, Expedia, Macy's, Sephora, CVS, the list is long. Save online, in-store, and at over 22,000 restaurants. And when it's time to redeem those rewards, get your money exactly how you want it. Choose PayPal, check, Bilt points, or cash out with gift cards. Eligible American Express card members can choose to earn membership rewards points instead of cash back. Terms and conditions apply. So go ahead, take a trip, fill a cart, order dessert. Rakuten is a world of rewards. Join today for free. Go to Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app. That's Rakuten.
So my news is from the Daily Beast, and it's so many of my interests in one. So one, it's Black filmmaking. So this young Black filmmaker who I'm now obsessed with, Jasmine Jones, who has made this documentary that is based on Mavis Beacon. Now, getting into the other thing I'm interested in, and we've actually talked about this on this podcast, is Black representation, particularly women's Black representation, and like what that means in American culture. And so let me tell you who Mavis Beacon is, or really is not. So Mavis Beacon teaches typing, was this classroom staple in the 90s for kids who wanted to become proficient in typing. So Mavis Beacon was really presented as this trailblazer for Black women in her field. She was lauded for her contributions. Students who learned her methods filmed testimonials to thank her. Her career was also lauded at the Kennedy Center by people like Barack Obama and Oprah Winfrey. And even our girl Wendy Williams went viral saying Mavis was an icon and the legend. Thank you, Wendy. The issue is that Mavis Beacon is not a real person. And so this software company basically hired this woman, Renee L'Espérance, who's a Haitian-born woman who was discovered working at a department store counter. So the developers of this software asked her to model as a typing instructor. She was reportedly paid $500 for her image and photographed once. And over the years, she's only given, and she has never given an on-the-record interview, and it has basically disappeared. So here comes Jasmine Jones, who first encountered, also I love this because it's like the young people really interested in the 90s, and I love that for Gen Z because it keeps us connected. So Jasmine Jones, who at 8 years old, she's from the Bay Area, she first encountered Mavis Beacon. She first encountered this, the software game, Mavis Beacon teacher software. She says that she's one of her pupils. I owe this woman so much. When I was learning the game, they have these little Black hands that mimic typing. It was so amazing to see a digitized version of a body like mine on screen at such a foundational age. But as Jones grew older, she realized that Beacon can be a bit of a problematic fave. As she's continued to work in the digital arts and to think about self-representation as a Black woman, she wanted to retrace her thinking steps and ask questions like, why was Mavis Beacon Black? What was the racialized and gender casting choice about? So this documentary basically is about that. It's about this journey, like really like a DIY journey. I can't wait to see this documentary. It just premiered at Sundance. A journey of who this woman is and why, you know, why she never gave an interview, why she disappeared, but more importantly, How was it such that this woman was built up in the psyches of so many people as essentially a real person? So I just wanted to bring this to the pod because I thought it was so interesting. And when we talk about Black women's leadership, or even when we talk about Black tropes, right? When we talk about, you know, a Michael Jordan or Oprah Winfrey and like what those kind of like exceptional Black people have meant in our construct of how we think about Black folks and racism, I just found this to be so interesting that like you can make up a Black person that really, you know, somewhat does something for both for white folks and Black folks. And really interestingly satisfy whatever the cultural needs of those populations are and be successful for so many years. So I don't know. I thought this was fascinating and was curious if you all were students of Mavis speaking, teachers typing. So
I'll go quicker because I know people are going to have brilliant things to say and I can't have mine get overshadowed by somebody's brilliance. Really, Miles, I need you to go after me. Let me just get my little talking points in here. Okay, so I am a student of Mavis Beacon. I did not follow all the way through, but I took it and we had a part of computer class that was typing and Mavis Beacon was that girl, as the kids would say. Now, what I find really interesting about Mavis Beacon is that she was working as a saleswoman at Saks when they found her and pay her $500 for a photo shoot. So that's like one. But the more fascinating thing about that is that they replaced her on the cover with just other Black women and kept calling her Mavis Beacon. I think that is
like Aunt Viv.
Wild. Yes. So she is the first model. And then they like Aunt Viv. And then they just keep they keep moving her. They keep swapping out her photo with other Black women. And I, you know, just somebody will say it much better than me, but needing Black people's validation to move things culturally is as old as this country is. And this one is just such a wild, wild thing. And the way they try and soften it when other articles have written about this is like, there was no industry around influencers. They didn't really exploit her because this was one of the first times and blah, 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 blah. It's like y'all made a gazillion dollars off of this woman who we thought was an expert. And you exploited her. So fascinating.
I'm going next. No, sir.
All of us, right? We're like, Miles, you got to go last on the culture stuff. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Especially because I did not know anything about Mavis Beacon until this conversation. I looked it up and I was like, how come everybody else knows about Mavis and I don't? And it is because she was introduced in 1987, which was my junior year in high school, and I had already taken typing, so I was past that and didn't have to go back to learn typing. And so I missed the whole cultural moment that was Mavis Beacon, but it reminded me a lot of the Aunt Jemima story, right? The appropriation of Black women as validators, as external validators for some product or something, the disembodiment of the character, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Aunt Jemima, there were lots of different people who portrayed that character. And it is the irony of it to me is, you know, people think we're stupid. People think that we, you know, are lazy. People think that we are whatever. But when you need somebody to endorse a product and make it valid, if a Black woman is using it, then it must be good, right? And so I find the irony around, you know, the broader society's perception of Black people versus, you know, their willingness to use us to endorse products as frankly a real example of a diseased mind. Like, this is what racism makes you do, two different things at the same time, I think. And now I'm excited to hear about Miles's profound reflection on this article.
That's too much pressure. I think what I was going to say was the through line between this and Uncle Tom and Aunt Jemima is just, it's a straight line, right? Two things that really stuck out to me about this is how right now everything is so simple where it's like black people get out, you know, or for some people it's like black people don't be a part of it. But there's something about them creating Mavis Beacon, her last name being Beacon, like Beacon of Hope, but like something about making her this like exceptional, excellent black woman who took all of her brilliance and all of her talent and said, what's the best thing that I can do with this? Help a white company and help y'all get into this same type of like this capitalist cult. Like that to me is what's interesting, because the people that you listed, I ain't about to get invited to nobody's parties, but the people that you listed, when I think about Barack Obama, when I think about Oprah, they sell us the same idea that we are this brilliant, that we are this, that we worked this hard, that we went to these exceptional colleges, and what is the best thing that we decided to do? Be a president. What is the best thing we decided to do? Get our own channel so everybody can watch us. What is the best thing we decided to do? Get on the airwaves, and even with Wendy Williams, she got absorbed into the cable, you know, television like monster as well. And they know that something about taking our excellence and taking our maybe talents for something and making it assist the broader mainstream white cultural project, there's something that happens to us psychologically. That's the first thing that came to my mind. The second thing is, this is a warning tale, because this feels also, yes, this happened in the 90s, but this feels very futurist, because now when it comes to AI, now when it comes to deep fakes, we know that Taylor Swift just had all those sexual deep fakes happen with her, where there's this Taylor Swift likeness being used to create pornographic images. We know that people more than ever are able, and companies more than ever are able to make fake mascots. And this may be something that is not just this one-off, well, this is a weird thing that happened in the 90s. Now, all types of companies that understand the value of certain types of personhood, certain types of identities, are able to create a person and create a mascot. And if we don't want to research every single person or research every single brand ambassador or influencer, because who got time for that, then we'll, before we know it, see, oh wow, that wasn't a black, queer, non-binary, androgynous person who has they, them pronouns. That was a series of codes, and they knew that this person that we just made up can actually sell more underwear, sell more products than this other person. And although we were able to make this like 3D symbolism that everybody loves, this is still going towards the same people who are always getting money. So yeah, this is a very interesting story to me, but also I think it's a warning, because I think that we're only getting heavier into our capacity to do that. I don't think that this is just this one-off 90s relic thing. I think that a lot of companies are going to be able to do that. And last thing I'll say is that I've seen fashion brands in particular already get in trouble for this. I've seen a lot of fashion brands get called out for using models that were AI and people didn't know. So it's not just something that I think might happen. We've already seen this, but I think the something about her having a history and having a name and having a culture and a biography around her makes it even a little bit more haunting. Oh, that was good. That was interesting. Okay. So I'm short and sweet this week, because it is the 24th. So, hey, y'all know I love an anniversary. I love, did you know this happened a few years ago? Because I think that our culture is so quick. And I also think that with every song and Billboard song that I hear, I become more appreciative that I was born in 91. And there was some bodies of work that were terrific, but also lasted. You know, when I think about how long people were critiquing Beyonce, or not even critiquing her, but talking about how Beyonce let an album ride for 2 years. And I'm like, yeah, you used to be able to let something ride for 2 years and tour it, and a video came out 2 years after the release of the album, and it would still push it. And this is the big build up to the fact that it's the 24th anniversary of D'Angelo's Voodoo. The reason why I want to bring this to the podcast is not just because we love D'Angelo and D'Angelo was fine and D'Angelo was making great music, but also because D'Angelo changed music with that album. And D'Angelo really began to bring in different sounds. So when we listen to what was happening, a curse word now, but Diddy, what Diddy was making, when we listen to the Bubblegum Pop, D'Angelo, along with the other Soulquarians like Erykah Badu and The Roots, and even like Goody Mob, I will put into that category, and Jill Scott, of course, they were beginning to make music that sounded like the music that was in the 70s, and they were able to kind of, for lack of better words, or maybe this is the perfect word, preserve a sound aesthetic that was being attacked. Was hip-hop was getting out of the golden age and was getting more commercial, as R&B pop was being was becoming mainstream, but then like with Brandy and Monica, but was also being pirated by Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears's. There were these groups of people, and D'Angelo was at the forefront of these people who are really preserving a sound aesthetic and a point of view that I think is really important. And even when I think about artists like Maxwell and Raphael Sadiq and Amel LaRue and Guapale, so I say all to say is I think it's super important to recognize that. And then I guess the bigger thing that I wanted to point out, what's happening in culture now, is that I think that that is not absolutely happening in culture, because Voodoo didn't just come out. Voodoo was a successful. That's what I always say about Erykah Badu too. I'm like, Erykah Badu didn't just come out. Erykah Badu came out and went platinum a few times. And Lauryn Hill didn't just come out. She came out and she won awards and went platinum a few times as well. And I always fear that there's not this kind of deliberate preserving of certain sound aesthetics and certain points of view in our current music. And I think when I think about albums that did this masterfully, I have to think about D'Angelo. And I don't want to totally discredit millennial and Gen Z and current generations, because I did just go see Samara Joy at the Blue Note. And I think that is a young woman who is totally preserving a certain sound aesthetic and point of view in this current time. And I hope and pray that there are more and more people who not necessarily just mimic old jazz sounds, but care about the drum, care about the things that are particularly African about what we bring to music, and know that if we don't preserve this point of view, then it's just going to, we're just going to be left with this kind of very flat, unimpressive, uninvolving type of music that is just not good for the soul or the mind. So, yeah, I wanted to remind everybody about D'Angelo's Voodoo this week. If y'all have any D'Angelo memories, because, you know, I was just a young thing with D'Angelo, but I will say, keeping it very PG, but that was my awakening. That was my awakening. I don't know if y'all didn't know this, but I'm not straight. I'm not straight. And D'Angelo helped solidify that for me. So shout out to D'Angelo with that entitled video.
That was worth the price of admission, honey. Oh my God, I learned so much. The awakening. Yes. I mean, you cannot talk about this album without talking about not just how do you feel. I think the real title is Untitled, but like that video changed videodom. Period, the end. And I read, because, you know, I was like, okay, let me read something about more than what I know, which is I love the video too. What I read was he became so uncomfortable. Like, he's such a musician and was dedicated to musicianship and plays multiple instruments and, you know, really wanted to be Prince-ish in his artistry, and became so disillusioned and disappointed that video cast him more into sex symboldom than into the sort of music iconography that he wanted, that he ended up really sliding after that album into alcoholism and depression and drug abuse, and had a really rough time out of that album, because as much as heralded as it was and how much of a star it made him, it was not who he wanted to be in the musical world. And it reminded me that all celebrity ain't good celebrity, that, you know, who you want to be as an artist is not always controlled by you and is controlled by the people who want to make money or who want to sell a particular image. And so while that image has resonance and endures for us, it is actually a point of pain for him. And so I thought that was a really interesting thing to remember. I mean, he's such an amazing artist. I saw him, D'Angelo and the Black Messiah. Is that the name of the new of the latest the iteration?
Yeah.
I saw him in concert with the Black Messiah, and the musicianship of this dude. I mean, he played different instruments. He pulled all kinds of 70s soul and funk. Like, what his music is, it's different. It's just different. And it's different in a way that resonates with who we have been, but there is also a futuristic feel to it. So it connects the old and the new. Like, I don't know where this cat is right now, but we need some more of that is all I will say. And thank you for bringing a very this was a good time in Black music. This was a good time. And thank you for reminding us of it.
I also don't know why I claim D'Angelo as a DC person. He's from Richmond. But I got to do something about my city. But growing up in DC in the 90s, there was so much music everywhere. And D'Angelo, Jill Scott, Erykah Badu, they would always do almost like a festival at Post Merriweather Pavilion.
Merriweather Post Pavilion.
And I would go, everyone would go. And then it was also just infused with like, it still felt like Marvin Gaye. It felt like Earth, Wind & Fire. It felt like Maze and Frankie Beverly, just like this genre. And it also was then punctuated by Chuck Brown and Rare Essence and a bunch of DC go-go bands. So it just was like, in the 90s, just Black music everywhere. So that's my memory, really, Miles, is that it just was, you know, because it was also like, it was this, but then we were coming off of like, for me growing up, coming off of like in the 80s, Janet Jackson and Another Bad Creation and New Edition. And like, it just was always vibing. And I feel like we had so many more spaces for all of that to happen. So shout out to D'Angelo. I'm just making you from Southeast DC, or at least you're honorary. So we appreciate you.
Kaya, I didn't know that he spiraled after this. I didn't know that it impacted him very differently than the way that it sat with so many people. And such an interesting commentary on how your best thing is not yours when you put it out, you know? Like, even when it is amazing and incredible, you can only hope that people do with it what you want to be done with it. And sometimes they do something else with it. So that is really, I'm gonna go read about that after this. Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Positive the People this week. Tell your friends to check it out and make sure you rate it wherever you get your podcast, whether it's Apple Podcasts or somewhere else. And we'll see you next week. Positive the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Evan Sutton. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.